good evening. It's great to see you all here, and it's a real treat for me to be with you here tonight in this beautiful theatre you have here in Livermore. Really a wonderful acoustic, a wonderful place to play, and I have to say I'm truly grateful to the Livermore Amador Symphony for this wonderful program we've been working on. I saw your regular conductor, Lara Weber, and I heard her perform at the Diablo Symphony in Walnut Creek last week. We're doing a conductor swap, and as she said, I highly recommend it. It was so that was a wonderful concert, and I'm looking forward to some great music tonight. I wanted to start this talk mainly talking about the Richard Strauss, the Death and Transfiguration, because this is really an extraordinary work. It's his second tone poem. The first came right on the heels of Don Juan. He wrote it when he was only 29 years old. And it was incredibly original orchestral writing. He just lived and breathed the orchestra from a very early age. His father was a horn player in the Munich court opera house, and Richard Strauss would just spend his time going to rehearsals, listening, taking lessons from anybody he could. Theory, history, orchestration, violin. So by his early 20s, he was a really exceptional musician already. And a big moment for him, as for many important figures, it seems, in the 19th century, a big turning point was in his mid-teens when he heard Wagner for the first time. And he heard the performance of Lohengrin, which was transformative for his own artistic development. And his father, however, was rather more conservative, musically speaking, and very much discouraged this newfangled music that was coming out and advised him not to be influenced by it. But when he managed to escape to Berlin, then he found his own, and when he immersed himself eventually in the music of Richard Wagner, and then from that point on, his own musical style really came into its own. And one thing that he particularly uses in his tone poems, which comes from the Wagnerian tradition, is the idea of the leitmotif, which is basically a small musical fragment which has a lot of symbolism attached to it. It's going to be something which is very recognizable and something which will also develop as the piece develops. So it's not something that necessarily stays exactly the same, but it will be something very recognizable that will be woven into the musical texture and then become part of the storytelling. So what I wanted to do to begin with is just to take you through a little bit the story of Death and Transfiguration in terms of the musical ideas that come through it, because if you can listen to those as you go through, I think your listening experience will be much richer. So I'm not much of a pianist, but I'm going to give you a little short tour of Totenverklärung, Death and Transfiguration. There are two main leitmotifs in this work, death and transfiguration. Starting with death. It's played on the second violins and violas. when you hear it with them, it's got this rather dark, breathy quality to it. And I think that Strauss would be rather good at writing music for horror movies. And of course, so many composers of movie music were inspired by Wagner and Strauss in particular. It's such imaginative use of the orchestra. This motif, which is basically a rhythm, there's no melody, it's just rhythm. It's a pulsating and starts very slow. And then you'll hear it coming in other instruments in the orchestra, next in the timpani. Starts to weave this rhythm into a bigger musical texture. It's interesting in this piece because he asked a friend of his after he wrote it to write a poem about the piece, which, to tell the story, where very often a composer will find a poem and use that as inspiration for his piece of music. In this case, it was the other way around. But his friend, Thomas Ritter, who was also a composer, violinist, poet, describes the scene at the beginning, which is the dying man, and the struggle that happens between the man and death. And then the final, in a very idealistic way, the final transfiguration of the soul into perfection, ideal perfection at the end. So this is the overall trajectory of the piece. But in the meantime, the man has these visions of his life passing before him throughout the piece. So when you hear the music then go into the major at the beginning, this is one of the more happy moments, and you'll hear it with the harp and the solo violin. Slow introduction, but before long, a shadow passes over this memory, and it's as if suddenly a cold cloud has passed over the sun. There's a little wind which is set up, first of all, in the double basses, and then in the English horn, signifying something darker to come. Interruption by death, but if you heard just before that sudden change there in the horns is the death motif again coming back. The next section of the piece is a big struggle between the dying man and death, so it's like two different characters in the piece, and it builds so up to a big climax where we get the next important leitmotif introduced for the first time. So you'll hear this rising melody, this time in the horns, trombones, and strings. Signifying perhaps the aspiration, the desire of the soul, the desire of humans for something more eternal and more perfect. Though as you can hear, the way that that melody got resolved that time was very imperfect, it was very unsatisfactory, and we have to wait until the very end of the piece, until we get a real resolution to this transfiguration motif itself. But that moment then brings us into the bigger part of the main part of the tone poem itself, where now we lay out his whole life in grand gestures. We had little fragments and memories of it at the beginning. Then you'll hear that love melody coming back again in the flute and the violins. Then onto his middle years, a heroic theme with military connotations then comes in the middle. Between this rising melody and then the motif of death. Suddenly in the trombones and the timpani, we hear the sign of fate. And each time that death leitmotif comes in more intense, it comes higher and it gets repeated more insistently. This is a short version. And we get to the top of the orchestra, and then. Desire for resolution until the very, very end of the piece. He does this by setting up expectations and then deceiving us, taking us in a different direction. And musically speaking, the strongest way, the strongest tool that the composers have for that is one chord, which we call the dominant. And the dominant has a very strong pull to the home key, or the tonic. And the longer we stretch out the dominant, the more we want it to resolve eventually. So this is what Strauss does here. Doesn't quite take us home quite yet. And here it comes again. And finally, the soul is at peace at the end of the work. The trumpets are the last instruments to say farewell. Lebe wohl, farewell. And that figuration would have been very recognizable to any 19th century listener. It's what we call horn fifths, because they're the naturally occurring notes which could be played on a natural horn or a natural trumpet. And those instruments would have been heard in many different non-musical contexts, for example, out on the hills for hunting horns, but they were also associated with the post or the mail, the post horn, bringing letters, love letters, which were being waited, people were waiting for, but also people traveled in the post carriage, so it became a symbol of farewell, that final figure that we hear in the Strauss. So I hope you enjoy that piece tonight. The other three pieces are very much linked together in spirit. The Schubert Rosamunde, so-called Rosamunde Overture, he actually didn't write it originally for that play. He'd originally written it for a different play. It's incidental music to a play, Die Zauberharfe. We don't know much about the play, it's lost, but we know it's, as they describe it in German, ein Ritterstück, or or Zauberspiel, so basically about magic and knights in shining armor, which is exactly what Lohengrin is about too. So there's definitely a gothic element to this program. There is one particular historical figure who links the two pieces in the second half as well. The two pieces in the second half are both swan related. The eccentric King Ludwig of II of Bavaria was obsessed with swans and obsessed with Lohengrin. He also, just like Strauss, heard it as a teenager, and it completely took over his life. He built whole castle, which later became known as Neuer Schwanstein, the new swan rock castle, and he had it designed so that some of it would look like the castle of Brabant in Lohengrin. Rumor has it that Tchaikovsky was actually really very fascinated in this strange character of Ludwig II, and that maybe in his ballet, the character of Siegfried, the Prince Siegfried, who wants to rescue the Princess Odette, who's been turned into a swan through a curse, and that maybe the Prince Siegfried is actually inspired in some way by the eccentric Ludwig II. At this point in the talk, I would like to welcome a couple of musicians onto the stage, because we have some wonderful solos in the second half in the Swan Lake, especially solo violin and cornet and trumpet. So I wanted to welcome now Tina and Steve Anderson to talk about their solos.
Thank you.
and I look forward to the concert. We have a couple more minutes, so I don't know if anyone has any questions. No questions. Yes. Yes, the poem was written. In fact, I have it up here with me. It was by Thomas Ritter, his friend, written in German. I can read the beginning for you, actually. So, in the small, poverty-stricken room, only dully illuminated by a candle end, lies the sick man on his cot. He has just struggled once with death in wild desperation. Now, exhausted, he has sunk into sleep, and the quiet ticking of the clock on the wall is all you can hear in the room, in which the fearful silence is a premonition of the approach of death. Around the pale features of the sick man plays a sorrowful smile. At the confines of life, is he dreaming of the golden days or childhood? But death does not grant its victims sleep and dreams for very long. It shakes him awake cruelly, we heard that bit, and starts the battle anew. The urge for life and the power of death. What a horrible struggle. Neither one wins the victory and it becomes quiet once again. And then he goes on to talking about how he sees his childhood pass before his eyes and then his life as a young man. And as in Strauss so often, these are very thinly veiled descriptions of himself, or how he imagines himself. And a lot of it is Strauss, the musician, struggling for ideal perfection against all the pettiness of the world, by which he's usually referring to the music critics. he talks about the pettiness which he struggles against. But then the last blow of death's iron hammer rings out, breaks the earthly body in two, and covers his eyes with the night of death. But he hears, it's very late 19th century, he hears mightily resounding from heaven that which he sought to hear longingly, world redemption and world transfiguration. So there's no small ambition in this piece. Thank you for the question. Any? One more question, I think, if there's time. No? Well, thank you so much.